In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with novelist Peter Carey. Peter Carey was born in Australia. He now lives in the United States. He's the author of several novels. A number of them are set in Australia. Among his novels, Jack Maggs, Illywacker, Bliss, The Tax Inspector, there are others. He wrote Oscar and Lucinda, for which he received the Booker Prize. That's Britain's top literary award. He's now traveling around the country talking about his newest novel, which is titled True History of the Kelly Gang. It is the story of Australia's last and perhaps most famous or infamous bushranger. That is a bandit who was active along the frontier, the Australian frontier, in the late 18th and 19th centuries. And Ned Kelly was executed in 1880, but he continues, I think, in many ways, for Australians to be very much alive. Certainly is a figure of great controversy. Some people think that he is indeed a kind of a folk hero. One might almost say an anti-colonial freedom fighter, and other people are horrified at that notion. They say he was just a criminal and a murderer straight out. Now, the book, The True History of the Kelly Gang, is Ned Kelly's story, his telling the story of his own life. It told in a very unusual style, and I think you might find it interesting. It's published by Knopf. It's not been out very long. And we're glad that Peter Carey could be here and talk with us. And as we talk, of course, you can call in, people who are listening, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Mr. Carey, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And thank you very much for talking with us. One of the things that came along with the book was a copy of an article from an Australian newspaper that it with some interesting things in it. And I guess the thing I wanted to ask you about first, though, was a quote here where you said that this was the book that you waited your whole life to write.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
That's a sort of a scary thing to say, isn't it?
Well, it puts a lot of pressure on you in the book,
yeah,
I guess.
I can actually remember the night that I said it. I was sitting next to this Bill Buford, who's a fiction editor at the New Yorker magazine, and I turned to him and I found myself saying this, and then I saw how he was listening, and then I became terrified. But terror aside, I do believe it is true. I mean, it's true for a number of reasons. When I came to literature sort of a little late. You know, most of my friends were reading great books when they were 12 and 13 and 14, and I really wasn't doing that. And it was not till I was nearly 20 that I really discovered literature. And then I started to read all in a weird sort of order. And the one of the first books that I remember reading which really ignited me was a very short book by William Faulkner called As I Lay Dying, and where the story is told from changing points of view of these poor rural characters. And the thing that struck me, I didn't know language like this existed in the world. I opened this book, and there's just amazing language, and it's the interior lives or interior imaginings of these poor people. And so what Faulkner's doing is saying, well, here are these people who might look like, you know, people not worthy of your attention, but this is what the inside of their minds is like. And I thought, you know, the language I just fell in love with. And, of course, I found other people like Joyce and Beckett, whose language was also amazing soon thereafter. But the thing that I particularly liked was this thing that Faulkner had done in a way. It's sort of like giving voice to the voiceless. And probably because I was young and inarticulate and no one ever waited for me to finish my sentences, I probably identified with this at a very deep level. But there's a... And then it wasn't all that long after that that I read a letter that the historic figure Ned Kelly had written himself, a 56-page letter he'd written in his own defense. And by then, as I said, I'd been reading Joyce and Beckett, and suddenly I come across this other voice, not a literary voice like theirs, an uneducated voice, but full of this great rush of Irish, a great stream of prose, not very heavily punctuated, a sort of a cry of pain in one way, a protest, but also with a lot of humour and energy in it. And I'd grown up, Australians tend to grow up sort of knowing about Ned Kelly, and Ned Kelly's the guy that, you know, he's a famous bushranger, we admire him, he was brave, he made weird iron armour, which is how he's remembered. But this voice in this letter, well, DNA had just been discovered then, so I guess I wasn't thinking about DNA, but it really is like the character's DNA speaking from, you know, beyond the grave. You can construct the man again from this language. And so, and it was years and years and years and years went by. And I was living in New York, and I saw I went to the Met, an exhibition of paintings showing Ned Kelly. I'm telling my Manhattan friends this story. And one of the great things about living away from your home or your own country is it starts to look stranger and stranger. And I sort of rediscovered the sort of wonder of this story and thought I would write a novel. And then for me, there was no question as to how I was going to write it. I was going to write it in this sort of voice.
Well, that's something I think that is very unusual. And I did want to hear more about how you developed that voice. And apparently it was indeed inspired by this piece of writing of his so that you didn't... You did not invent this out of whole cloth. You were taking off from something that really was his voice.
Well, it's partly that, and of course, it's partly that, and indeed, I did start to write. My first draft was very close to, you know, replicating his voice. In the end, it was not didn't really totally suit my needs, and I had to find another way of doing something that was true to it, but was also true to me. And I had the great advantage, although it didn't feel like such an advantage at the time, but in the late 40s and early 50s, going to this small rural school in the state of Victoria in Australia. And there were a number of relatively poor people in that school, and kids who would say, you know, I come into the room and there he were. And there's a big part of the sort of the spirit of this book, really, that sort of feels like it grows out of quite deep personal soil. And so that when I finally felt the voice was right, I never felt like I was making it up. You know, I never had to worry about what was right or wrong.
Well, at some point I want to ask you to read so people will get a sense of it. I think also I want to say, as for anybody who might pick up the book and start looking at it, that I had this experience at the beginning of finding it a little difficult to figure out how to read it, and because of the lack of punctuation. And then I think after having read, 40, 50 pages, then I think I discovered you just can't worry about that. You just have to kind of go with the flow, and that if you do that, it's okay. I think the problem is the reader, for me at least, as a reader was initially, I'm thinking, okay, I should place punctuation here. And I think that's the wrong approach to take to the book.
I think I was just saying to someone yesterday that many readers of my novel Oscar and Lucinda got to the end of it and were so angry that it didn't end it the way they wanted it to end that they threw the book across the room. And I've had many people come to me and say, I love Oscar and Lucinda, it's just a wonderful book, but I have to tell you, when I finished it, I threw it across the room. So I started to think I wouldn't mind a dollar for every mile it had traveled. But I didn't want anyone to start this book throwing it across the room. And I am, you know, well aware that, you know, when, you know, commas are very useful things. And when you make a decision to leave out commas and some full stops, you've got a big, big obligation as a writer to make it very easy for the reader. You know, no one's, one's readers are not sitting on desert islands with one book. You know, they've got many, many things to do with their lives. So what I did set out to do, and I hope succeed in doing, was in the opening of the book. In a way, one is teaching the reader how to read the book, and I really hope that it's reader friendly.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is novelist Peter Carey. He was born in Australia, now lives in New York City. He has written several novels, including a couple of that we've mentioned, Oscar and Lucinda, for example, was made into a movie. Maybe some people have seen that. He got the Booker Prize, which is the top literary prize in Britain for that. His most recent, Jack Maggs, and then, of course, his actual most recent, the one here we're talking about, The True History of the Kelly Gang, is now just out recently, published by Knopf. And if you'd like to talk with him, you certainly can call us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Not to spend too much time on this, but I also was struck by this same newspaper story about the fact that I gather when the book was published in Australia, some people were just fuming about it because they thought that Ned Kelly should not be regarded in any way, shape, or form as a hero, and they were rather unhappy with the portrait that you paint.
Well, you know, David, I think the interesting thing is that when you say the newspaper article, I know which one. and it's one of those things that sort of tends to enter the food chain, but. I think in all of the press in Australia about my book, and that, let me tell you, there was an enormous amount, and I'm sorry for sounding boastful, but there were two pieces that were negative, and both of them seemed to me to be sort of beat ups. One of them has that wonderful quote from the former police commissioner of New South Wales, who happened to be an Englishman, that said that the Australian's obsession with Ned Kelly reflects the black heart of nothingness that lies at the heart of the Australian character. So, you know, I don't know whether we're dealing with very reasonable people here. I think mostly most Australians do not have a problem. There's a folk song that which I think sums up how most of us feel, which says, "Those who blame him are but few." But still, you can imagine that, you know, if you were in a certain position in society and you wanted to be taken seriously as a very dignified person, you might not like it that your country's biggest story was about someone who's hanged for killing three policemen any more than you might like it to have a national song called Waltzing Matilda, which celebrates a hobo, you would say, a swagman who steals a sheep and then is caught by the police and then commits suicide rather than go to jail. Yeah. And so you might be embarrassed if that was a song that all of your friends and neighbours liked, and you mightn't want to stand up in an international forum and put your hand over your heart while that was sung. Mm. And you might be upset about Ned Kelly, but most people are not. And so the interesting thing is, it's not like I invented Ned Kelly, and it's not like I selected Ned Kelly from this vast array of, you know, interesting people to write about. It's that, in a sense, you know, the society has selected him. And well, the interesting to me is why would we do that? Yeah. Who are we? What sort of people are we that we have this hero?
Well, I would just go and observe that I'm certain that that one's reaction to the book and also to Ned Kelly might indeed be shaped by who you were. It so happens I'm married to someone who is half Quinn and half Kelly, so I'm somewhat sensitive to you know, the Irish experience, and that if indeed you were English or Irish or, you know, something else, and you thought about the experiences of your forebears and who was oppressing whom, that might lead you to feel one way or another.
Well, in my case, it's not. I'm partly Welsh, partly Cockney, partly Irish, partly English. So I'm not really, I didn't really go into it in that particular way. As a matter of fact, to tell you the truth, David, when I thought that I'm going to, write this book and it's an interesting story, and I realized I was going to have to start reading all of these books about Ireland, I really didn't want to do it. You know, so it's not like at the beginning that I had any huge sort of, you know, attraction towards the Irishness of the story, although it is a hugely Irish story, but it didn't grow out of my family history in that way.
I know, I'm sure authors hate it when quotes from previous interviews come back to haunt them, but I'm just was looking at a story from the New York Times in 1992. At this point, you said that after you wrote Oscar and Lucinda, you vowed never to do another book set in the past because it took so much research. And you said, I hate being in libraries because I always feel there's something I'm missing. Well, and this book is set in the past. Jack Maggs is set in the past. So obviously you got over that.
Well, you know, I still feel the same thing. I think one of the things about Australia and Australian history, you know, and I suppose it's true of all national histories, is that there are so many lies and so many silences and things that we've not come to terms with. And in my country, there seem to me that there are all these things that we've got to sort of go back and get right before we can go on. One of the very big subjects, which I certainly haven't grappled with full on, is the whole question of, you know, the land and our relationship with the indigenous people. If you were in Australia today, you would find this subject, you know, like the newspapers filled with it, and they have been filled with it for the last, you know, 5 years at least. The past has to be sorted out some way before we can go on. And this whole question about Ned Kelly is a story that's been lying there. We think we know it. All my friends, you know, when I said I was going to do this, they said, why would you bother? We know all about it. But it seemed to me an intensely unexamined story. So for me, I have to keep on going back to the 19th century. I don't like the 19th century particularly. I mean, I'd really rather write science fiction. I mean, in a way, the past, in a sense for me, is not unlike science fiction, in the sense that no matter what, after all the research, in the end, it is all made up.
Well, this is interesting because in one of the reviews of the book, the reviewer makes the observation that while your novels are set in the past, they are in very real ways modern novels, and I think too, whenever you look at either historical fiction or science fiction, those books are as much about the time in which they are written as they are the time in which they are set.
Absolutely.
And having said that, I wonder, you know, in what way, say, the true history of the Kelly gang is really about now, is really about 2000 and not so much about 1880.
Well, I don't know how to answer it really directly, except to say that the way I was thinking about it was, at the beginning, who are we? Who are we now? What sort of people are we that we would have this as our biggest story? Not just as a figure in our history like Jesse James is in American history, but as our single most important story. And so that's something, in our looking at those questions, that really is to do with who we are. You know, what sort of national, you know, character does this suggest? And I do believe in national character. And one of the ways, and you know, a friend of mine, a young woman from Melbourne, hearing I was writing about Ned Kelly, started to curl her lip. And I said, she couldn't help herself. I said, why are you doing that? And she said, oh, well, it's all that sort of old white male Celtic stuff that, you know, there's nothing to do with me, you know. And I remember having this conversation with her, talking about how foundation myths just continue to, you know, keep on going through layer after layer, and they don't go away. And that's why actually I quote Faulkner at the front of the book, saying the past is never dead, it isn't even past. And I think it's true of this. And one of the really interesting tests of one aspect, if I'm not rambling too much, of this, is that, you know, at the Olympic Games in Sydney, the audiences, the crowds there, are made not of the old Australia, you know, the pre Second World War Australian, which was, you know, English and Irish and Scots and so on, but a huge, you know, a big multicultural crowd, and they seem to me to be exhibiting the values of the society that loves the underdogs. And so that when Eric the Eel, the swimmer from Africa, arrives and is nearly drowning trying to swim to the end of the pool, that crowd cheered him, and later, you know, made him a sort of a folk hero of Sydney. So this is a thing that comes through from our very, very beginnings. You know, the respect for, not quite worship, but the love of the underdog. And I fear, David, I've got off track on my answer.
Let me ask you another question, because apparently, as what little I've read about it, Ned Kelly was the last major bushranger, and He was executed in 1880, and shortly after that time, the Bush Rangers pretty much disappeared. And I wonder if whether also part of what the book is about is in a major a point at which Australia was changing in some very important ways.
Well, I guess so. I mean, the fact that he was the last really is something that I've been made more aware of since I finished it. And certainly, yeah, at the beginning, yeah, the Bush Rangers were often ex-convicts or escaped convicts who took to the bush and survived, you know, through, you know, robbery and so on. And in this way, I think the nation, even though he's called a Bush Ranger, I think Ned Kelly is a slightly different figure. I mean, he's a fugitive who, you know, was involved in a fracas with the police where a policeman was shot in the hand and they had to flee. Certainly, you're right, there were no more after him. I've really not spent an awful lot of time thinking about why that might be.
We're at the midpoint here. Maybe I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with novelist Peter Carey. He's, for the last 10 years, has lived in New York. He was born in Australia. He has written a number of novels, and a number of them have indeed been set in Australia. He has won every major Australian literary award. He's also won the Booker Prize, which is Britain's top literary award. He won that for Oscar and Lucinda, which was published in 1988. A previous book, Illywacker, was also shortlisted for the Booker. His newest novel is True History of the Kelly Gang. It was published in Australia last year, just the beginning of this year, in the United States, published by Knopf. And questions welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'd very much like to have you read something so people can get a sense of what Ned Kelly sounds like.
Okay. Well, here's just a little bit. Like, this is about a minute. And this is from very, very early in the book. My first memory is of Mother breaking eggs into a bowl and crying that Jimmy Quinn, my 15-year-old uncle, were arrested by the traps. I don't know where my daddy were that day, nor my older sister Annie. I were 3 year old. While my mother cried, I scraped the sweet yellow batter onto a spoon and ate it. The roof were leaking above the camp oven, each drop hissing as it hit. My mother tipped the cake onto the muslin cloth and knotted it. Your Aunt Maggie were a baby, so my mother wrapped her also. Then she carried both cake and baby out into the rain. I had no choice but follow up the hill. How could I forget them puddles the colour of mustard, the rain like needles in my eyes?
And the we should explain to people that the premise of the book is this is his life story that he is writing down near the end of his life for a daughter, a child that he would never meet, so she could have some sense of who her father was, what his experiences were, and why it is that his life went the way that it did.
One of the things that he's doing, I think, is writing towards not just to his child, but to a better future. You know, he imagines at the very beginning, he says, God willing, I will live to see you read these words, to witness your astonishment and see your dark eyes widen and your jaw drop when you finally comprehend the injustice we poor Irish suffered in this present age. How queer and foreign it must seem to you, and all the coarse words and cruelty which I now relate are far away in ancient time. So, you know, his position is deeply optimistic about the future, at least.
And what's really striking, I think, at the beginning is that he's very committed to his family, to his mother, to trying to make a home. And even though fate continues to try to push him in particular directions, and eventually does push him in a particular direction, he seems to be trying pretty hard to cobble together as normal a life as possible.
Yeah, and I think a very difficult thing, you know, in the circumstances, given the fact that this is like poor rural Irish equivalent of the project, with, you know, the mother selling illegal alcohol and a lot of, you know, stealing and, you know, vaguely criminal cast around him. I think quite a difficult thing to do. I think the thing that you mentioned about family and mother. I mean, one of the things that, I mean, this is a novel, but I really was interested in you know, where history was known to acknowledge that, and where there were tendencies one could see in the history that had never been brought out to emphasize them. And one of the things that seemed to me to be very clear looking at this story, when you look at what drives this man, is that, and something that Australians had never thought about too much. I mean, they know the mother's this amazing woman, very wild, strong, and willful, but this is, seemed to me, the more I wrote, to be a story about a son and a mother. Mm-hmm. This is the oldest boy whose father dies when he's 12, and he and the mother form this, you know, economic survival unit, if you like. And then, and so you can imagine how closely they would bond. And then, of course, then the mother, they live in this little hut, tiny, tiny room, you know, with just curtains hung across for a little bit of privacy. And the mother's got lovers and husbands and babies are born. And you can imagine how the, you know, when we imagine a hero, and he is a hero to most of us, we don't allow for the fact that the hero might be jealous of his mother and mother's boyfriends. But if you think about a boy, you can imagine that this might have quite an impact on him. Mm-hmm. And so the more I thought about him, and especially you read the things that he's writing at the end of his life, you know, when he's writing these letters, he's saying, you know, I am a widow's son, outlawed, and must be obeyed. His big drive was to get his mother out of prison. So it seemed that one of the things that I believe to be historically true that I discovered in this novel, this made-up thing, is that, you know, this relationship between Ned Kelly and his mother is a motivating force in this story.
We have a caller, someone on a cell phone, so why don't we talk with them? Sure. This is our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hi, I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about how being an expatriate informs your writing about, or influences your writing about Australia, and also about, you know, the experience of being in America, which is, you know, another sort of New World, former British place. And just, can you talk a little bit about that? I'm going to listen off the air. I'm afraid I'm going to start.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Well, you know, if I'd not been an expatriate, I might never have written this book. The thing. One of the wonderful things that comes from living away from your own country is that your own country gets to look very, very strange. And as you explain yourself to your friends, or if you listen to the words of Waltzing Matilda, or you, as I did about 4 years ago, I have to go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in Manhattan to see an exhibition of very famous in Australia paintings of Ned Kelly by Sidney Nolan. And I go with my friends and I explain the story. And the story, which I love these paintings, but explaining them and explaining this narrative to my friends made me really see the strangeness and beauty of it and the power of it. And also, because I was, you know, if I was living in Australia, you know, I would know that there was probably a Ned Kelly discount muffler store and a Ned Kelly hamburger and a Ned Kelly this. In other words, a lot of kitschy rubbish around this story. And being away from home, being away, filters all that stuff out, and one is just left with the wonder of the story. So I think that's one of the gifts that you get for living away. I mean, you get a lot of things that are not gifts, like a lot of, particularly because I'm so still very interested in exploring what my country is and so on. You get a sort of an anxiety from being away from it, that you somehow, you know, the river's changed its course and you don't know, and so on. Being... You know, everybody says it's a cliche, you know, that New York is not the United States, and I know it's not the United States, but it's New York that I know. I now have two American children, and it's odd for me to. I mean, I love them, and I'm totally happy that they're happy. But well, I mean, I can remember one turning point in my life was when my oldest son, who said, we bombed Iraq. And I said, no, they bombed Iraq. And he said, no, we did. So, you know, there are certain discomforts. I'm used to taking a critical stance towards large imperial powers. I'm not used to being implicated in these actions.
Going back just to talk a little bit about the relationship between Ned and his mother, one of the things that happened in the life of the real Ned Kelly, at one point the police show up to arrest one of his brothers. He was, I guess, cattle rustling, and a fight broke out, and the policeman was wounded, and the boys fled. His mother was put in jail. In the story, in the true history of the Kelly gang, there's one point where they put together enough money so that they could leave. And there's this idea that they could leave Australia and go to America, and Ned won't go because his mother's in jail. Mm. Is that at all a reflection of what actually happened, or is that, again, something that you imagine that certainly would have been in keeping with probably with the way that he felt about his mother?
It's not. I made it up. No. I mean, that particular thing. But the things that we know is that the notion of fleeing to America is not out of the question. that they discussed it. The notion of fleeing and getting a boat from certain places is something that was talked about. So we know I'm not inventing that as a notion. The possibility of that sort of. We know that. What else do we know? We know that once they'd robbed the bank, they had money. We know that he was totally obsessed with this question of getting his mother out of jail. We know that even though he can lead the police on a merry chase, that in the end he can never be pardoned or never be free. It would just seem to me to make sense. Mm. But I've made it up. It's a novel.
In more than one review of your books, I have seen reviewers draw comparisons between you and Charles Dickens, and certainly Jack Meggs invites that kind of comparison. But I wonder more generally how you feel about being compared to Dickens.
Well, so I guess this is the time. This is the time for true confessions, right?
You've never read any, right?
Well. You know, I remember, to be compared to Dickens, I take to be a great compliment. And it was when my novel Illywacker, which was published in 1985 and was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. And at that time, people started to compare me to Dickens. And it was at once wonderful to recognize one was being complimented and at the same time embarrassing to have to confess one had not read Dickens. And that doesn't necessarily make a literary writer sort of look all that great, I guess. But I'd had a lot of trouble with reading Dickens. And every time somebody like Nabokov writes, he's got a wonderfully persuasive lecture about Bleak House, which I started to read. And then I found this saccharine little girl who I couldn't bear, and so I put the book down. But so I hadn't read Dickens at all. And then I was reading a book by Edward Said called Culture and Imperialism. And in this, he's writing about Magwitch and Great Expectations, and he's showing an enormous amount of insight into the Australian colonial experience. And he writes about Magwitch, the convict in Great Expectations, as somebody who can only be an Englishman as long as he's banished, and the minute he goes back to England, he'll be hanged. And I'd always been interested in our convict roots, and I still am, in the convict experience, and could never think of a way in which to write about it. And it suddenly occurred to me that this might be a vehicle, a way in which I could deal with all sorts of questions to do with self-hatred, self-knowledge, and things which were to do with the story of my country. And so then I went to Great Expectations and read it, and I found, to my great delight, a great novel, a perfect novel. And then because I got into the notion of Dickens as a character as well, or a character like Dickens, I read his earlier novels and read quite a lot about his life, and so it all becomes part of the business. But it's my own self obsession. It really isn't to do with a great passion for Dickens.
Well, certainly one thing that it seems that you share is an interest in marginalized people. It seems to me that many of your characters are marginalized. They're outcasts or misfits or people that just really don't quite fit in.
What can I say? I wouldn't be a novelist if I was normal. I mean, there's some this observation. I never quite know what to do about it. One could say it's a sort of a political position. That's an act of sympathy or of empathy. one could say it's the self-expression of somebody who's always been a bit of an outsider. But I don't know. I don't mean I don't feel, you know, if we go to a restaurant and have a meal together, I don't think I'm going to feel terribly outsiderish. sometimes there are things, you know, about how you write and what you do, which, in the, if you said to me, why do you walk like that? And I said, I don't know. It's just the way I walk. So sometimes I think there are just things that one does, and I don't know why I do them.
Well, I suppose the explanation might be something simple, as simple as that. Maybe normal people who are entirely normal aren't very interesting. It doesn't give you very much to, you know, who was it that said all the happy families are alike and the unhappy ones are all unhappy in their own ways?
Scott Fitzgerald, was it?
No, I think it was someone who was Russian.
Really?
Well, anyway, that shows how poor my education was. Let me, again, here, I'll haunt you with a quote from a previous interview. And I guess I'm interested in this particularly because I have read Jack Maggs. And this was this 92 piece in which you said every book is in some way a reaction to the one before it. Yeah. So I wonder, you know, for example, in what way is this book, The Kelly Gang, a reaction to Jack Maggs? And then maybe you might talk a little bit about what you're working on at the moment.
Okay. I think one of the things that I realized in writing Jack Maggs, which is, you know, set in Victorian England, and there was a way that I wanted the sentence structures. While the sentences are modern, or they're pared back in a way that, say, someone like Dickens isn't, but still I really wanted to obey the laws of sort of Victorian grammar and the way they're punctuated and certain choices of words give this sort of feeling to it. And it was, for me, as a writer who's always done whatever he damn well pleased, it was a little bit like wearing a corset. You know, you had to sort of, you know, I felt constrained. Well, I was pleased to be constrained, but when it was all over, the notion of writing like Ned Kelly in this, you know, untutored, passionate, relatively unpunctuated prose seemed like an enormous relief. And, of course, these are sort of tricks one plays on oneself, because in the end, in fact, the discipline of writing like this is enormous. It's far more difficult to write like this than it is to follow, you know, the more conventional rules of grammar, if you want people to read you. So in that way, and then I think in the way, too, in which it was, you know, although Jack Maggs is ultimately about Australia and the Australian experiences, the convict colony and so on, it's set in London, and this book was set in Australia, and I've not actually written a book for two books. The two previous books had not been set in Australia, so it was a huge, huge pleasure to return to my own soil in that way.
One seems drawn to compare the Australian experience and the American experience, and wonder to what extent that helps form the character of these two countries and whether they're as alike as they seem to be.
I think, you know, this question is everything. and I think they're really only very superficially alike. And there's all sorts of, you know, you can just start with these two, you know, the two different first fleets. You have the Mayflower on the one hand with its, you know, religious refugees, and you have these, you know, these convict ships with people chained together and jailers on the deck, you know. So this is a totally different experience. We're here because we want to be here on the one hand. We don't want to be here at all on the other. And then you have just the whole nature of the landscape. And, you know, these two, Australia and the United States, are roughly the same size. But, you know, the Australian landscape is incredibly... It's an El Nino landscape with, you know, floods and drought and fire and so on. And it also has a huge amount of it is just desert. So the experience of those colonizing or invading or whatever you want to call it, in Australia, you know, we generally went west. You guys, your narrative, you're going west to, you know, people died, of course, and there was heartache and tragedy. But the general drift of the thing is you go west to wealth and success and so on. We tend to go west and get lost and die. And maybe there's a lot of the Irish aspect of our character, in this, not a majority but a strong minority. means that we maybe started not trusting success and treasuring failure anyway. But all of our stories are about failure. I mean, you know it is Burke and Wills, the explorers who get lost and die, and they die of starvation, by the way, within yards of Aboriginal people happily going about their normal life because they don't eat what they're eating. And you know, Gallipoli, you know, where our young men died for no good reason in this foolish battle. And everything we trust is lost, and Ned Kelly's one of those. Mm.
We are at the point where we have maybe about 6 or 7 or 8 minutes left with Peter Carey. He's a novelist. His books are all in print, and all except the newest one are available in paperback, so you might want to take a look at them. And the newest is published by Knopf. It's just been out here, I guess, a couple of months in the United States, True History of the Kelly Gang. He's traveling around talking about it.
And well, should I mention, sorry, David.
No, go ahead.
Should I mention that I'm doing a reading tonight in Chicago at the Newbury Library on 60 West Walton Street.
Very good.
So it's at 6:30.
So people who are, if you're in Chicago, you could stop by. And I looked at your tour schedule. This is grueling. Was it about 17 cities that you're going to be doing? It's not continuous, but
that's a lot. Yeah.
You're just at the beginning. I'm glad I'm talking to you at the beginning and not at the end.
Well, you know, I've got a lot of mini bars ahead of me.
I don't know if I expect in Australia probably there are movies, or maybe they're not movies made about Ned Kelly. There's one that apparently is not all that highly thought of, starring Mick Jagger of all people.
You didn't have to mention that.
I'm sorry, but I asked by way of saying, you know, it seems that this is the kind of thing that might people in Hollywood might be interested in. Making a movie about it. Is there some talk about possibly another movie about Ned Kelly based on your book?
Yes, and actually it's better than Hollywood in a sense, because it's Neil Jordan, the Irish film director.
The man who made The Crying Game.
Yes, so he's optioned the book. And for me, not only is he a director and a writer who I admire immensely, but the notion of an Irish director and writer going to Australia with some Irish actors and using Australian actors and working within that landscape is very moving to me, because one of the things there's books to do with is lost memory and the what's forgotten by immigrants, what's denied by immigrants. And there's a whole lot of stuff in this book which interests him. So he's going to be able to do something, add another whole extra layer. I mean, he won't make the book, of course. It's going to make a film. Mm-hmm. But I think what he can bring to this is going to be, it's just so exciting to contemplate.
Yeah. Going back again to that newspaper article, there's a photograph here of Ned Kelly's death mask. And I guess the thing that I'm struck by looking at it is how much he reminds me of Phil Collins. Huh. I'm thinking, you know, maybe Phil would like to. Of course, Phil's kind of a short guy. I guess that Ned Kelly was kind of a big guy.
He was a big guy, yeah.
Are you working on something now? Can you talk a little bit about what you think you'd be doing next?
I normally would have been more advanced on my next book, but the thing that I did when I finished this, I've just finished another very small book. Bloomsbury, an English publisher, have commissioned literary writers to write about world cities. And for instance, they asked Edmund White to write about Paris, which he's just finished doing. And they said to me, would I like to write about Sydney? And but not a travel guide. It could be anything I like. I could invent it, whatever it was, 50. So it gave me this wonderful excuse. When the minute I'd finished Ned Kelly, to say to my wife, well, this is a very good thing. I need to go to Australia for a month. And indeed, I went to Sydney for a whole month, stayed with very good friends, and because the book really basically is about my friends and their lives, I had the great fun researching it, and so I'm just finishing it now, and then I'm going to get onto a novel.
Hmm. And you have a plan for this novel, or?
Yeah, but I'm being a little coy. I mean, because I haven't done enough work on it, so I'll be a little secretive.
No, well, that's all right. We'll look forward to it. We're sort of coming down to the end point, and I didn't want to, you know, I don't want to give the book away particularly. I don't want people to tell people too much. I want to tell them enough so that they might be interested in looking at it, and yet not so much that they feel like, all right, I've heard the story of this book, and I don't. It would be redundant to actually go and read it. But the quality of the prose is so sort of unusual that I was wondering if you just might just read a little bit more.
Sure, of course. Excuse me while I just this is, I'll read you a little bit from he's about 12 years old, and they're living on a little farm which they're renting. They're very, very hungry, and they're poor. And here we go. There were no dam or spring upon our property. Each day I took the cows to water them at Hughes Creek. In a good year it would have made a pretty picture, but in the drought that creek were no more than a chain of sandy water holes. It were across this dry river bed that Mr. Murray's heifer calf come calling out my name. I were very hungry when I heard her and knew what I must do. I'd never killed nothing bigger than a rooster, but when I saw the long line of the heifer's crop above the blackberries, I knew I could not be afraid of nothing. Her eye were a little wild, but she were a Poll Hereford and very sleek. I later heard that Mr. Murray had made a great investment on her and potted her with corn and hay, which must be true, for there were no feed in any of his paddocks, and although he owned 500 acres, his stock was out grazing on the roadsides, finding what nourishment they could. I did not care. I bailed her up and led her down the creek into a thick stand of wattles with a clearing in the centre. She did not like the rope around her neck. She fought and bucked and would have done herself a damage had I not bound her hind legs and tied them to a wattle trunk. She began to bellow terribly. Soon she were trussed up like a Christmas chook, but I had no pity, nor did I have a knife. I ran up through the scrub to fetch one from the hut. Inside, my mother were occupied trying to plug the spaces between the slabs with clay and straw, so I took the carving knife from beneath her very nose. She never even noticed. Said she, "There's one of Murray's beasts caught down by the creek." "Ah, you must be mistaken." "No, I can hear it bellowing from here." I said I would attend to it and let her know. Within the year I would have learned to kill a beast very smart and clean and have its hide often, drying in the sun before you could say Jack Robinson, but on this first occasion I failed to find the artery. I'm sure you know I have spilled human blood when there were no other choice. At that time I were no more guilty than a soldier in a war. But if there was a law against the murder of a beast, I would plead guilty, and you would be correct to put the black cap on your head, for I killed my little heifer badly, and am sorry for it still. By the time she fell, her neck was a sea of laceration. I will never forget the terror in her eyes.
Well, there we must leave it. There's some beautiful writing in the book. I think it's very good, and I would recommend it to folks, and I certainly appreciate you taking some time and talking with us about it.
Well, thank you, David.
Our guest, Peter Carey. The book is True History of the Kelly Gang, published by Knopf. All of his other books are in print as well, so if you like his writing, you can seek him out. And best of luck on the long haul.
Okay, David. Thanks so much.